So when I was in high school, I got to go to France. My family took a family trip. And while I was there, I decided that I wanted to send my grandfather some stinky cheese. He had grown up eating stinky cheese. He had never actually been to France. His parents were French and Belgian. He was first-generation American, raised in Massachusetts. This is the one that just celebrated his 90th birthday that I told you about. So I was in France, and my brother and I went to a little fromagerie, a little cheese shop near our hotel to look for cheese. And I remember talking with the shopkeeper. I had had a few years of high school French, and I said, I want the strongest cheese you have. And he looked at me, you know, in my rudimentary French, I was able to convey, I want the strongest cheese that you have that I can ship to America. And he took us over to this refrigerated shelf and said, you know, these three are all approved for shipping, and they are also very, very strong cheeses. Why don't you see if you can choose from something from these three? And I remember my brother and I gave them all the sniff test, right? We picked up the first one. Ooh, it was pretty strong. Picked up the second one. Ooh, it was even stronger. The third one drove us away. We said, that's it. That's the one we're going to get. Now, this particular cheese was wrapped. It was like a round of brie. You know, it was very soft in the center and had a crust, a rind around the outside. And that was wrapped in plastic, which was wrapped in aluminum foil, which was sealed in a wooden box. And when I purchased it, he put it in a paper bag and then into a plastic bag with handles. And I figured I would take this back with me to my grandfather. I mean, it was a cheese that had already been around for many, many months or years, so it wasn't going to go bad. So I remember I stuffed it into my duffel bag and wrapped it in my clothes and then left it in the closet in the hotel. Well, we went out for the day. Well, now this was in August. And when we got back to the hotel room, we knew something was wrong because there was a little note on the door that said, maid service was not able to service your room today. Please see the front desk. So we took that notice down to the front desk and asked what happened. And they're like, something died in there. Maid service refused to go in because the smell was the smell was so bad. So we went inside. Now this was wrapped. I told you how many layers it was wrapped in, and it was stuffed in the middle of a duffel, completely blanketed by clothing. And the smell was so bad that the entire room was permeated. We tried to air it out, you know, and it didn't work very well. So my mother said, you have to get rid of this cheese. We cannot carry this with us for the next 2 weeks through France and then England. All my clothes had to be washed. The smell would not, they couldn't air out. So so the next day, I went down to the post office. And the post office was built in a long row of desks, probably from the back of the narthex where the sink is to maybe the cross, a long, thin room, you know, with desks with clerks behind them for quite some ways, and then all the post office boxes at the end of the room. And I walked in with the plastic, with the plastic bag, and waited in line with everybody else. And I remember we were there for a few minutes, and people at the far end of the room started sniffing in the air. You know, with they weren't sure. Is that, you could see them talking, do you smell that? They were saying, do you smell that? And so I got in line, and I waited, and the clerk was not very friendly. And she said, what are you trying to mail? And I said, I'm mailing some cheese. And she smelled the smell, and she gave me this look and said, le fromage, tu peux pas passer le fromage? Cheese, you can't mail cheese. And I said, yes, it's approved for shipping. And I showed her the little label. And she was not sure, but she had to take it because it said that it was approved. And she took it. So now let me tell you, this was back in 1991, I believe. And normally if you shipped a package, it would have taken approximately 2 weeks to get from Paris to San Jose, California. It got there in 4 days flat. Because, you know, every single post office said, we do not want this here, and they sent it. When it arrived at my grandparents' house, my grandmother found it on the front porch, and she did not know what it was, but she was pretty sure there was something dead in it. So she took it outside and put it in the backyard to wait for my grandfather. He loved it, let me tell you. He was told he had to eat it outside. My grandmother still complains that she had to throw away the Tupperware container they stored it in because the smell wouldn't come out. But he claims it was delicious, and I believe him. I believe him. So, yes, he still has cousins in France that actually we got to meet, and one of them laughs just like he laughs. They have the same laugh. even though they've never met. So today we learned about Abraham's blessing and the gifts that immigrants bring or mail to America. And I studied immigrants, I studied refugees when I was getting my MA in biblical studies, because I noticed a pattern. Through a series of events, I noticed a pattern in the Old Testament. Not the New Testament, just the Old Testament. I want to make that clear. About blindness, about how blindness appears a lot. There's a lot of talk about it. There's a lot of metaphor around it. There's a lot of poetry around it. A lot of, you know, threats to strike people blind. A lot of, you will be blind, you will be deaf, things like that. And then there's all these characters that go blind in the Old Testament. I'm not sure if you're aware how many men in the Old Testament go blind. Have you realized this? Can anybody think of any that go blind? Yeah, most people can't. You don't think of it as an issue until you realize that there are nine. There are nine. Isaac goes blind. Samson goes blind. Eli the priest goes blind. Zedekiah, the last king of Israel, goes blind. The Arameans, a whole army of Arameans, goes blind in 2 Kings. The men of Sodom, in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, remember how the angels strike them blind? They go blind. Tobit, in the Apocrypha, goes blind. Jacob goes blind at one point. And the prophet Ahijah, from the book of Kings, he also goes blind. In short, there are over 100 different metaphorical expressions of blindness over 23 books in the Old Testament, and at least 9 characters that go blind. And as I studied these characters, I started noticing, and as I looked at the metaphorical expressions, where they're using it in poetry and such, I started to notice common patterns. I started to notice that this is a metaphor that is used consistently in the same way. And it came to understand that it's a cognitive metaphor. This is a metaphor that exists in a society, and people use it as a general expression. For example, in this culture, if I were to say to you, I'm in a relationship and we're on the rocks, right? We're at a fork in the road, right? We've come to an impasse. You know, we're noticing that our tires are a little deflated, if you know what I mean. You all understand what I'm talking about. You understand that, you know, I would say I'm in a relationship and it's in trouble in various ways. We all understand this? Yeah, if I were to say it looks like our transmission needs to be re-oiled. Have you ever heard anybody say that before? No, but you understand what I mean when I say it. Okay, that's because in our culture, we have a cognitive metaphor, a metaphor that everybody understands at a cognitive level, that love is a journey. And that within that metaphor, the vehicle represents the relationship. Whoever's in the vehicle is in the relationship. The road is the time that passes in the relationship, and any obstacles that that occur along the road are troubles that may occur in the relationship, right? If we say we're riding off into the sunset together, you know what that means. The horse is the relationship. Riding off into the sunset means a happily ever after. If the horse, you know, throws a shoe, we all know something went wrong. Does that make sense? It's a cognitive metaphor. Most cultures have cognitive metaphors. People oftentimes speak in metaphor whether they realize it or not. And as we look at this recurring metaphor in the Old Testament, we see again and again and again blindness associated with certain specific things. They are death or threat of death, extinction of the family line, meaning we're not sure if our children will be able to have children and whether or not our family line will be able to continue. Gross injustice. Being ostracized by a community. Experiencing a spiritual desolation, a feeling that we are separated from God, or God is angry with us, or God isn't talking to us, or God isn't listening to us for some reason. A sense of wickedness. We have done something wrong. We've broken a rule. We've erred in some way. And an overall sense of distress. We're upset, we're lamenting, we are terrified, something of that nature. Again and again, these come up in relationship to blindness. And when you look at these different characters in the Bible, these different men that are experiencing blindness in their lives right before they go blind, all of these things are present. They are being ostracized by their community. They are under threat of death. They are worried about the continuation of their family line. They are experiencing some sort of injustice. They are feeling separated from God, whether that's true or not. They're feeling it. They're worried that they have erred or they have committed some sort of infraction, and they are highly distressed. They're very, very upset, and they're feeling a lot of pressure in this situation in general. And what I discovered as I looked over these and as I studied the history going back 4,000 years, and I studied 4,000 years of history just to be able to see if I could find even a single instance, a single century, some point in that time period where people weren't massively being moved around due to war or famine or forced exile or something, and I wasn't able to find it. Refugeeism and exile and being moved around permeated the society in the biblical context. It permeated the society. Weather changes, wars, family strife, the big bads, the Assyrians and the Babylonians used to move people, forcibly exile them after they conquered a city. Refugeeism was a constant. If you weren't actively experiencing it, you were watching other people experience it. People that lived in towns, if they weren't having to move for some reason, they were watching people flood in or flood through talking about it. There was no one in that society for 4,000 years that wasn't touched by people being exiled for some reason. Everyone was a refugee, or everyone was in contact with refugees. And if they weren't at that moment, they probably were third or fourth generation and their family had experienced it recently. So, what we come to find out is that these men in these stories, and Abraham is one of them, he experiences blindness at one point, serve as a metaphor, among other things, they serve as a metaphor to express something that was happening in that society that was absolutely overwhelming and difficult to describe, much like love, right? Love is an overwhelming thing that's very difficult to describe. The only way we can find to describe it is in poetry and metaphor. Try describing love in legal terms. Good luck. Good luck. The concept of exile, the concept of becoming an immigrant, whether you wish to or not, and everything that happens in that transition, everything that immigrants experience, and maybe some of us in this room right now are second or third generation Americans, and we have not experienced that in a while, but when we ask our grandparents and our great-grandparents about what it was like to come to the United States, they will talk about the struggle to stay alive. They will talk about the worry about what will happen with their children and their children's children. We want them to have a better life, but will they survive growing up being of a different culture, being a different color, speaking a different language, looking and acting differently? They will tell you about the injustices that they suffered. They will tell you about the ostracism. They will tell you about the questioning in regards to spiritual desolation. Why are we suffering this way? Why has God abandoned us? Where is God in all of this? And all of those questions around their spirituality. And they will tell you of the experience of distress, what it was like. Is there anybody here whose parents or grandparents, when they immigrated over, had it easy breezy? Just coasted right through. No problem, no sweat. No, it's tough. It's really tough. And those often were people that wanted to come over, that maybe had a little money in the bank so they were able to make a fresh start when they got here. That doesn't even begin to talk about people that are flooding over as political refugees, that are fleeing a situation where there's not enough food to eat, where they are unsafe. And the problem that we see today is very similar to what we saw in the Bible way back when. The things that Isaac was experiencing, that Samson was experiencing, that Eli and Zedekiah and Tobit and Jacob were all experiencing are very similar to what refugees and immigrants continue to experience. And so this concept that we see again and again in the Bible, we see the theme of blindness, but we also see the overriding theme of the promised land, and we see God's repeated admonitions. Remember that you were once aliens out of Egypt. Remember and treat the aliens and the immigrants kindly. Do not forget where you came from. We see that again and again. Before today, none of you guys could think of someone in the Bible who might have been blind. But I bet you've heard about the Promised Land many times. Is there anyone here who hasn't heard about the Promised Land at some point? Is there anyone who hasn't heard the admonition? Remember that you were once aliens out of Egypt. That's because it's a recurring theme, because it was an important topic. It permeated society. And what's extraordinary about this text is this concept of the Promised Land, because it's one thing to think of it as sort of an afterlife sort of thing, but that's not the only context that it appears in. We see it again and again in Abraham's promise, I will give you this land so that you don't have to keep running anymore. There will be a place for you and your descendants that you can call your own, which will flow with milk and honey. There will be enough to eat for you there. Do you see that? It's a very simple promise, but it's an extraordinary promise because it's something that most people did not have. And if they did have it, they only had it for a couple of generations, and then they had to leave it for some reason. So the concept of a place that you could call your own that would be safe, where everybody would have enough to eat, where you could survive and your family could continue to prosper for multiple generations indefinitely, was a fantastical idea because it simply didn't exist. It simply didn't exist. And because these folks had gone through so much, this body of literature is extraordinary because it tells the story of the losing side. Do you realize that? Now, I've read the annals of the kings of Babylon and of the Assyrians and of some of them from the Egyptians. And let me tell you, all it is about we are the winners and let us tell you why. We are the winners. This is how we conquered. We are the winners and God was totally on our side. That's why we didn't have any adversity. No strife. We just came, we saw, we conquered, we kicked behind, and then we walked back out again. In this body of literature, we hear about how we were kicked out. We suffered. We worked really, really hard, and it didn't always work out very well. We had to leave even though we didn't want to. We were separated from family, and yet we persevered because our God was with us, because our God champions the most vulnerable. That's extraordinary. It's an extraordinary piece of historical work because it champions the people that normally don't get to write the history books. Does that make sense? It's an extraordinary piece of literature because it's written by people who normally don't get to write the history books. And the fact that it has survived this long is amazing to me. And so when we see this concept of the Promised Land flowing with milk and honey, and we see it again in the book of Revelation, it's the same thing. The New Jerusalem, the New Zion, is just a place where everybody will have enough to eat, everybody is safe, and it's a place we can call our own. We don't have to leave again. And God will live with us. We'll be a godly people. But the concept is the same. The promise is the same. And while we often remember the concept of the Promised Land, and we often remember the concept of treating aliens and refugees and immigrants well because it's repeated, give me one second. What we often forget is Abraham's blessing. And that's why I wanted to read those two passages together. They occur chapters apart, but there is a blessing there. Where God says, be fruitful and multiply, we remember that part. Remember, oh, we are all children of Abraham. You know the little song we sing in Sunday school? What we often forget is that he says, your people will be blessed and they will be a blessing. Which is really important because it means that all of those times that they went to other places, that they weren't welcomed, that they were kicked out, they were still a blessing. And when we look at immigration today, we have to remember, just like our families came, and we get to enjoy all sorts of wonderful things now that weren't there before, right? German sausages. Mm-hmm. Black coffee. I would love to say that came from France. The love of it came from France, but it really came from Africa. It came from Ethiopia. Stinky cheese. Or mild cheeses, if you guys go that way. American cheese, whatever. Right? all of these blessings that we have come from immigrants. And as we look at all of the things that immigrants face, the fear of death, the blessing that comes from that is an incredible will to survive, a will to persevere. We know that that first generation in our family worked probably 2 or 3 times as hard as we ever had to work because they were determined to survive. That's a blessing. That has something to teach us. When they're worried about whether or not their family's going to continue, we get to see wonderful adaptations, things like mixed marriages, people marrying outside of their faith, outside of their ethnicity, outside of their social class, in an effort to survive. And we get to have wonderful unions and new beginnings and peace between families that wouldn't otherwise have occurred because the children are determined to continue the family line. When we see instances of injustice and immigrants experience injustice, we know this. We also see wonderful things like our Bill of Rights that says we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Only a country founded by immigrants would have come up with something like that because they knew what it was like to be in countries and to be in situations where people were not treated as equal, where there was a presumption that some people got more and other people got less, that some people were more important and other people weren't quite as important. Now, America is still trying to figure out exactly how to live out that truth. We're still trying to figure out how to live out that truth. Sometimes we fall flat on our faces trying to live out that truth, but we still hold it as a truth, that all people are created equal. The other wonderful thing that I think is such a blessing as people come and they immigrate and they move around in all countries, from all countries to all countries, from all cities to all cities, is that every time we move, we have to adapt. We have to figure out how all of the things we used to do are going to fit into where we are now. And we get to distill and we get to discern what is truly, truly important and what can we let go of. What is absolutely important to continue? What cultural foods must we continue to eat? What languages must we continue to speak? How are we going to continue to teach our children about our culture? And what are we going to embrace that's new? And how are those going to blend? And that is a constant conversation that has been going on for thousands and thousands of years. Every time we're forced to move, every time we're forced to change, we get to really think about what's important. We get to really think about what we value as a culture, as a country, as a family, and we get to figure out what we're going to do next and how we're going to continue that on. My children have French names, and they like stinky cheeses. They're not so sure about the coffee yet, but they're definitely sure that they love coffee. One of my proudest moments was when Faye was 18 months old, and I was eating a blue cheese. It was actually, I believe, a Stilton, you know, a really strong, smushy blue cheese on a Triscuit, and she wanted to try some, and I didn't think she would like it, but I gave her some anyway. Gave her a cracker that had a big smear of blue cheese on it. And one of the proudest moments of my life was when she presented to me, 60 seconds later, a soggy cracker, devoid of cheese, and demanded more cheese. And then she proceeded to drink half of my cup of coffee with milk and sugar in it. That I had to put a stop to. But we learn, our children learn what we teach them. And as immigrants continue to come to our country, and they will continue to come to our country, whether it's to seek a better life, whether they're ready to thrive, or whether or not they are literally fleeing with the clothes on their backs from a very, very traumatic and distressing situation, much like many of the people in the Bible had to do. They are blessed, and they are a blessing. They are blessed, and they are a blessing whether they want to be or not. Just like we are, just like our parents were, just like our grandparents were. Whether we want to be or not, we are blessed, and we are a blessing. can I get an amen to that?